So, you know what? What always kind of gets me about standard economics,
What's that?
it's how much time we spend talking about how the machine is supposed to work, the beautiful theory,
Right, the textbook version.
versus how it actually works when it, smokes and sputters and just breaks
That
down.
is the eternal struggle. The beautiful theory versus the messy, messy reality.
No, but seriously, think about a recession. In Econ 101, the solution seems, well, obvious. If people stop buying stuff, businesses just lower the prices.
And if unemployment goes up, wages dip a little until everyone's hired back.
Exactly. The system is designed, at least on paper, to self-correct. It should be like a thermostat.
But it isn't, not even
It
close.
isn't. Instead of a thermostat, it's more like a car crashing into a wall. It breaks, and it stays broken for a really long time. And that gap between the perfect theory and the messy reality, that's what we're looking at today.
It's the trillion-dollar gap. And honestly, it's the entire reason macroeconomics exists as a separate field. I mean, if markets cleared instantly, we wouldn't need a Federal Reserve.
We wouldn't need interest rate adjustments, and we definitely wouldn't be having this conversation.
Right.
So we're doing a deep dive today into a concept that sounds, I'll admit, incredibly dry, but it's actually the secret engine of the economy, nominal friction.
And we're working off a heavy hitter source here. It's Chapter 18, Nominal Frictions and Business Cycles by Alasdair MacKay and Morton Raven.
This is the handbook on New Keynesian economics, right?
It really is.
New Keynesian. It always sounds a bit like a rebranding exercise to me.
Well, ideally, it's an evolution. The old classical view was that money is neutral.
Neutral, meaning what?
The idea was if the government just prints twice as much cash, all the prices just double. Nothing real changes. You don't get richer. The numbers just get bigger.
It's like measuring a room in inches instead of feet. The room doesn't change size.
Precisely. But history, specifically the Great Depression, kind of destroyed that
Yeah,
idea.
you can't really look at 25% unemployment and say, oh, don't worry, money is neutral.
You can't. The Great Depression proved that the whole market clearing thing can fail, just spectacularly. You had factories sitting idle, people desperate for work, the gears were jammed.
So New Keynesianism is the study of that grit in the gears.
Exactly. It's trying to explain why prices and wages are sticky, why they don't adjust instantly, and how that stickiness lets money impact real things, like whether you have a job.
And that's our mission today. We're going to audit the price tag. We're going to find out if prices are actually sticky, why, and how the Fed plays this high-stakes psychological game to keep the whole system from collapsing.
And fair warning, sometimes the solution to the problem is a little more painful than the problem itself.
I love a good paradox. Okay, so let's start with the evidence. It's easy to say prices are sticky, but I feel like I see prices change all the time.
Sure.
I go to the gas station, the price is different by noon. I look at a flight, the price changes every time I hit refresh. Is the world really that sticky?
Yeah, picking the outliers there. Gas, airline tickets, those are what we call flexible price goods. They're tied to these huge, volatile global markets.
Okay.
But to get the real picture, you have to look bigger. You have to look at the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. And the source material here references this massive study using data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics.
So we're talking big data.
Huge. They tracked prices from about 23,000 different stores. We're talking 85,000 individual items across 300 categories. They basically watched every price tag, from bananas to car repairs, for years.
Okay, so what's the verdict? How long does a price tag actually survive out there in the wild?
The average, the mean duration is about 6.2 months.
6 months, huh? I don't know, that actually feels a little faster than I would have thought. I
Right.
mean, if prices are changing twice a year, that seems pretty responsive. Like, it should be enough to keep the economy moving.
You'd think so, but hold on. That 6.2-month figure is, it's a bit of a mirage. It's really polluted by sales.
Ah, the 20% off this weekend only trick.
Exactly. So if a store drops the price of a mattress for a holiday weekend and then puts it right back up on Tuesday, the data counts that as two price changes.
But nothing fundamentally changed.
Nothing. It's just noise. And the data shows that prices have memory. When the sale ends, the price snaps right back to the exact same regular price it was before.
It's like it was just held underwater for a second.
Perfect analogy. If you filter out those temporary sales and you look at the real reference price, that duration jumps to somewhere between 8 and 10 months.
So for almost a year, despite inflation, supply chains, everything, the price of a toaster or a haircut just sits there.
For a lot of goods, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's huge variety here. Economists call it heterogeneity. You mentioned gas, that's instant. But look at services. Your dry cleaner, your barber, those prices are incredibly stubborn.
Or a magazine. The price printed on the cover feels like it's there for a decade.
That is a classic example.
Yeah.
And interestingly, geography matters. The data shows prices in Europe are significantly stickier than in the US.
Really? Why?
Could be regulation, could be less competition. But the bottom line is, stickiness is real. The price mechanism isn't a fluid, it's viscous.
Okay, but why? I get that it's annoying to reprint a menu, these menu costs, but we live in a digital age. Changing a price is just a database entry. Why would you leave money on the table?
It's not just the cost of the sticker, it's the cost of the decision. The source points out this fascinating distinction. It says, prices react very quickly to idiosyncratic shocks.
In English.
If a frost kills the orange crop in Florida, the price of orange juice shoots up immediately. That's a sector-specific shock. The manager knows exactly what happened.
No oranges, raise price. Simple.
But prices react very, very slowly to macroeconomic shocks, like a change in interest rates or a little dip in national GDP.
So the manager's watching his own inventory, not the Fed's press conference.
Precisely. It's an information problem. They're steering the ship by looking at the waves right next to the boat, not the weather on the horizon. By the time they realize general inflation is up, they're already 6 months behind.
That makes a ton of sense. Okay, let's move to how we actually map this, because you can't build a model on Steve the manager isn't paying attention. How do economists turn this mess into a formula?
This is where we get into the new Keynesian model. And to make it work, you have to accept a few premises. First, you have to assume monopolistic competition.
Meaning firms have some power. They're not just slaves to the market price.
Right. If you run a unique coffee shop and you raise your price by 10 cents, you don't lose every single customer. You have a brand, a location. You have wiggle room. And that wiggle room is essential.
Okay, premise one, accepted.
Premise two is the, well, the more controversial one. To model the stickiness, economists use a shorthand called the Calvo pricing model, named after Guillermo Calvo.
I've heard this called the Calvo Ferry, which doesn't exactly inspire confidence.
It's a simplification, but it's a useful one. Imagine that in any given month, a firm isn't just free to change its price. Instead, it faces a random probability, a lottery, that it will be allowed to update its price.
So, literally, a fairy shows up and says, "Congratulations, you won the lottery. You can change the price of your lattes today."
In the model, yes. Now, obviously, that's not what happens in the real world. But this random chance is a good way to mimic the aggregate result of all the real-world constraints, contracts, manager attention, printing cycles. It actually works surprisingly well at the macro level.
Okay, but what's the dark side?
The dark side is, if you're a manager and you win the chance to change your price today, you know you might not get another chance for 6, 9, maybe 12 months. You're locking yourself in.
So I can't just set the price for today. I have to guess what the price should be for next year.
You have to be forward-looking. You're baking your expectations of future inflation, future demand, all of it, into today's price tag.
That sounds incredibly stressful, but what happens if I guess wrong? Or what about all the firms that don't win the lottery and are stuck with old prices?
That creates something called price dispersion. And this is the key inefficiency. Imagine two identical firms selling identical widgets. One gets to update their price to $12 because of inflation. The other is stuck at $10.
Everyone is going to swarm the $10 guy.
Right. So the cheap firm is working overtime, burning out its machines and employees to meet this artificial demand, while the expensive firm is sitting idle.
It's a total misallocation of resources. We're making too much of the cheap stuff and not enough of the expensive stuff just because of a timing glitch.
And that efficiency loss is why central banks hate inflation so much. It scrambles the signals.
So stable prices aren't just about convenience. They're about making sure the economy is actually building the right things.
Exactly.
This feels like the perfect time to bring in the heavy hand of the law, the central bank.
Enter the Federal Reserve.
And their job is to fix all this, right? To smooth out these glitches.
Their job is to manage interest rates, to keep things stable. We usually describe this with the Taylor rule. Basically, if inflation gets too hot or the economy is overheating, the bank raises rates to cool it down.
And this leads to my favorite term in the entire paper, the divine coincidence.
It's a beautiful concept, isn't it?
It sounds so spiritual for a bunch of economists. What is it?
In the simplest version of the new Keynesian model, there's no trade-off for the central bank.
No trade-off? You mean they don't have to choose between saving jobs and fighting inflation?
In that basic model, no. Think about the price dispersion we just talked about. If the central bank can keep inflation at exactly zero,
then firms never need to change their prices.
Exactly. My price from last year is still the right price. If prices don't need to change, then stickiness doesn't matter. There's no dispersion. The economy runs at maximum efficiency. So by stabilizing inflation, the Fed automatically stabilizes output and employment.
A divine coincidence.
It's a two-for-one deal.
But, and I feel a massive but coming, that is not what we hear about on the news. We always hear about the Fed having to cause a recession to kill inflation. Powell has to bring the pain. That doesn't sound very divine.
That's because the divine coincidence breaks down in the real world. It only works if the only problem is demand. But what happens if you have a cost push shock?
Like oil prices doubling overnight.
Or a pandemic snarling supply chains. All of a sudden costs go up and firms have to raise prices to survive. That creates inflation. But at the same time, those high costs act like a tax on the economy, so output goes down.
So inflation is going up and the economy is slowing down, stagflation.
And now the Fed is in hell. If they raise rates to fight inflation, they crush the slowing economy even more, causing a deep recession. But if they lower rates to save jobs, they pour gasoline on the inflation fire.
But divine coincidence just vanishes. They have to pick their poison.
And this is where it becomes a game of trust. The source spends a lot of time on what's called time consistency. It's this battle between discretion and commitment.
Okay, break that down for me.
Imagine a big inflation shock hits. A central bank, using discretion, looks at the situation and says, okay, what's the best thing for the economy right now?
That sounds responsible. Be flexible. Adapt.
It sounds responsible, but it's a trap. Because if businesses know the Fed is flexible, they know the Fed will eventually cave. They won't keep rates high forever because they don't want mass unemployment. So businesses just, they don't lower their prices. They bet on the Fed blinking first.
So being flexible actually makes the inflation stickier.
Yes. Now compare that to commitment. This is the Odysseus strategy. The central bank ties itself to the mast. They say, we are going to keep interest rates high until inflation is dead, and we do not care how much it hurts employment in the short run.
That sounds ruthless.
It is. But here's the paradox.
Mm-hmm.
If businesses believe that threat, they lower their prices immediately to get ahead of the curve.
Because they're forward-looking. They see the pain coming and they react now.
Correct. The source shows a simulation of this. Under the commitment policy, where the Fed promises to be tough, the recession is actually shorter and less severe than if they try to be nice and flexible.
Wow. So by credibly promising to cause pain, they avoid having to inflict it. It's like parenting.
How?
If my kids know I am 100% serious about turning the car around, they stop fighting instantly. If they know I'm bluffing, we argue for 3 hours.
That is a perfect description of monetary policy. It's only effective if it anchors expectations.
That is a terrifying amount of psychological chess. But look, we've been talking entirely about businesses and prices. What about us, the workers?
The labor market.
Right. My paycheck is a price. It's the price of my labor. And it definitely doesn't change every month.
And that might be the bigger problem. The source suggests that sticky wages are actually more dangerous than sticky prices.
Why is that?
Well, think about the data. When they look at wage adjustments, there's this massive statistical anomaly. They call it the spike at zero.
Meaning a ton of people get a 0% raise.
Huge numbers of people get exactly zero change. But almost nobody, and I mean almost nobody, gets a negative change. In nominal terms, employers almost never cut your pay.
Well, yeah. I mean, if my boss came in and said, tough quarter, we're cutting your salary by 5%, I'd probably quit. Or I'd at least stop trying so hard.
And that's exactly the psychological hurdle. It's morale suicide. So wages are downwardly rigid. They can go up, but they can't really go down.
So what happens in a recession? Deflation hits, prices for goods drop, but wages stay high.
Suddenly, labor is incredibly expensive in real terms. The business is selling its product for less money, but still paying you the same. The math just breaks.
So they don't cut your pay.
They cut you. They stop hiring. They lay people off. And this creates slack in the labor market. You get all these willing workers who are basically priced out of a job because the wage number refuses to adjust down to reality.
So it's a double whammy. Sticky prices mean we buy the wrong stuff. Sticky wages mean we can't get hired.
And when you combine them, what the source calls the compound effect, it explains why inflation and recessions are so incredibly persistent. It takes a long, long time for both prices and wages to grind their way to a new equilibrium.
So we have the theory, we have the microdata.
Yeah.
But does this actually play out in the big picture? I mean, when the Fed cranks that interest rate dial, does the economy actually flinch?
Generally, yes. But proving it is surprisingly hard.
Why?
Because the Fed usually raises rates because the economy is already doing something, like overheating. So separating cause and effect is a nightmare. It's a chicken and egg problem.
Right.
The source points to some famous work by Romer and Romer. They dug through Fed transcripts to find times when the Fed raised rates not because of the economy, but just because they wanted to change policy. A pure shock.
And what did they find?
The data confirms the theory. When rates go up, output falls, and eventually inflation falls. But there was a weird little mystery in the data called the price puzzle.
Ooh, a puzzle. I like it.
In some of the data sets, right after the Fed raises rates to kill inflation, inflation actually goes up for a little bit.
That shouldn't happen. That's like hitting the brakes and having the car speed up for a second.
It drove economists crazy for years. But the consensus now is that it's probably just a data artifact. The Fed likely saw inflation coming. They have better forecasts than we do. And they raised rates in anticipation.
So the data just sees rate hike followed by inflation and thinks the hike caused it.
When really the inflation was already baked in. The hike was the umbrella going up right before the rain. The umbrella didn't cause the rain.
That makes sense. But there's one more layer of sluggishness the source mentions. It's not just prices and wages. It's us, our habits.
Habit formation. This is crucial. Even if prices changed instantly, we don't. If interest rates go up today, you don't cancel your vacation and sell your car by tomorrow afternoon.
No, I've already booked the Airbnb. I'm going.
Exactly. We smooth our consumption. We defend our lifestyle. And this means the economy's reaction to a shock isn't instant. It's hump-shaped. The peak impact of a rate hike might not be felt for a year.
Which makes the Fed's job even harder. They're steering a super tanker with a steering wheel that has a 12-month delay.
And the brakes are sticky.
Just a nightmare. Okay, so bringing this all together. The mission was to understand why the economy doesn't just fix itself.
And the answer is nominal frictions. It's the fact that we humans, businesses, workers are slow. We're slow to update our mental models. We're slow to update our contracts. And because we move slowly, money isn't neutral. It's a real force that can push the whole economy off a cliff.
It reframes the whole idea of a recession. It's not just bad luck. It's a massive coordination failure. We're all just stuck at the wrong price points, waiting for someone else to move first.
And that leads to this really provocative idea mentioned at the very end of the chapter. If the problem is uncertainty about the future, maybe the central bank should be even more aggressive. Maybe they should try price level targeting.
This was the wildest part for me. Explain how that's different from what we do now.
Okay, so right now, we target inflation. We say, let's try for 2% this year. If we miss and hit 5%, we basically say, oops, oh, well, let's try for 2% again next year. We let bygones be bygones.
We forgive the past sins.
Price level targeting does not forgive. It sets a long-term path for prices.
Mm.
So if inflation is too high this year, say prices go up 5%, the central bank is then obligated to force inflation to be negative next year to get back on that original path.
Wait, so if we have a boom today, the Fed has to legally promise to cause a recession tomorrow to undo it.
Yes. They would manufacture a recession to drag prices back down to the target.
That sounds politically impossible. Vote for me. I promise to lower your wages to fix last year's mistake.
It sounds incredibly painful. But the theory is, if everyone knew the Fed would do that, nobody would raise their prices too much in the first place. The certainty of the future punishment would keep everyone in line today.
It's the ultimate tied to the mast strategy. The threat is so severe you never actually have to use it.
Theoretically.
Mm.
But would you want to live in the test case for that theory?
Well, that is a question I will leave you, the listener, to mull over. Would you be willing to sign up for a guaranteed manufactured recession just to make sure the price of a loaf of bread is perfectly predictable 10 years from now?
It's a high price to pay for certainty.
Indeed. Thanks for listening to this deep dive into the sticky, messy mechanics of the economy. Hopefully the next time you see a price tag that hasn't changed in 3 years, you won't just think cheap lunch. You'll see the macroeconomic chaos underneath.
Until next time.
See you at net.